Good afternoon. In case you don't know it yet, we're into the political season, and we're going to be knowing a lot more about it. Just some other things that are going on today, for example, the ballot board is meeting to settle on the language for a redistricting issue that is going to be on the main ballot. It's Ohio. It's a day of the year of the end of the decade. So, of course, politics is very important to us. Among the many things that will be happening in the year 2018 is every statewide elected office, except for some Supreme Court justices, will be up for election. And the people who now hold those offices are all term limited. So that means we will all need to be getting to know a lot about a lot of people in very short order. One of those we are getting to know today is Keith Faber, who you may know in previous incarnations as the Senate President, the Ohio Senate President, and now a House member. He was elected in 2016. As Senate President, he was there from 2013 right through last year. And it was a time when Republicans absolutely dominated the state legislature. And as often happens when we start to think of people as R's and D's and nothing but, we learn that there are many ways of looking at things within the party itself. He declared last year, that he's running for auditor of the state. He will be running against a Democrat. Zach Spacey will be with us in a couple weeks. But before moving into that life, he was one of the RNC delegates in Cleveland for 2016 for the Republican National Convention. And got to be a force on the floor. For any of you who have not attended a Republican National Convention, I've now been to four, they are a fascinating event. Even though we may start to think of them as theater in a way, it is so interesting to see the individuals who make up an event like that and the power and the force that goes into something like that. I've only been to one Democrat, but I can say the same thing there. Keith Faber, beyond his role at the National Convention, his role at the State House, at the State Senate, in the State House now, he is on the Agriculture and Rural Development Committee, the Finance Committee, the Governor Access and Oversight Committee, and the Public Utilities Committee, all of which have some pretty important issues that are before them. He has said of himself that he has a reputation of sometimes being a little too direct. I believe that's a direct quote, but that his number one interest is always to do what is good for Bob and Ben Buckeye, which I think that means us. So without further ado, I will have Mr. Faber come to the podium and talk about why he wants to be awesome.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm going to talk a little bit about me, a little bit about the auditor's office, but the part I look forward to most is the questions. I have more fun with questions usually than giving prepared texts. First of all, let me tell you a little bit about myself. I come from Salina, Ohio. If you don't know where Salina is, it's right along the Indiana border, pretty much in the center of the state. Like most Ohio small towns, we look out for each other, we keep our word, we expect our government leaders to use our tax dollars wisely. Those are the values I took with me when I first was elected to the Ohio legislature. Those are the values I relied on as the president of the state senate, and those are the values that will be my touchstones as I run to serve as your state auditor. The auditor plays a key role in ensuring the kind of accountability that makes government more efficient, more effective, and more transparent. I've taken to calling the state auditor's office Ohio's chief compliance officer, and it makes sense if you look at the things that the state auditor's office does, and we'll talk about that here in a minute. But one big example is if somebody's a public official and they're lying, stealing, or cheating, the auditor's office is one of the places you go to flag that, and we have a place for those folks. It's called a jail. Look, I have no sympathy for people who are elected officials and aren't doing their jobs. I have less sympathy for people who are elected officials who are misusing the public trust. Our current auditor of state, Dave Yost, has done a fine job. His background is both an attorney and a prosecutor is a good fit. I've also, as an attorney, been someone who's prosecuted cases and handled complex financial litigation cases. That experience should help me as an auditor. But my experience in the legislature will add a new dimension to my service as auditor of state. As a lawmaker, I have worked to solve problems, to find ways to make government more efficient. and to, where possible, find relief for taxpayers. And nearly everything I've done as an elected official, and I'll talk about some of this in a minute, we've aimed at helping the folks of Ohio, as was mentioned in my bio, helping Bob and Betty Buckeye. And my family, like a lot of families here in Ohio, we didn't grow up with a lot of resources. My mom was a single mom. She was a nurse who worked hard, actually worked overtime, so us kids could have nice Christmas and birthday presents. I can remember, frankly, Mom and our family emphasizing the importance of hard work. I can remember shoveling snow and mowing lawns before I was 10. I remember my first paycheck job as a janitor at Culligan Water Conditioning even before I was a teenager. And then I had the opportunity to work at that great American icon, McDonald's. You know that place where you learn if you have time to lean, you have time to clean. The reality is, as the youngest member of my family, I was the first one to go to college. I was fortunate because I had some scholarships and I had the ability to work my way through undergrad. I had the opportunity to do some really neat things. I had the opportunity to clerk for a judge. I had the opportunity to be a probation officer, all while an undergrad. Then I had the opportunity to go to law school. I had some scholarships, but I worked my way through law school as well. Bartending, waiting tables, all the things you need to do to make the ends meet. In the end, I'm honored to say that Ohio, the good Lord, and hard work have blessed me in this land of opportunity. I met my wife at a company we both started working for in Salina. Andrea, who is currently the chair of the math department at Rhodes State University, by the way, who just earned her PhD at Christmas time. I'm really proud of her. We have two children, Adam and Brooke. Adam is a 12-year-old 7th grader. Brooke is a 10-year-old 5th grader. And like most of you, we love our kids. And while we aren't perfect parents, we always try to be parents first. And that's why I believe in Ohio, and that's why I'm working hard to be your state auditor. Now the reality is, let's talk about our campaign, and then I'll talk a little bit about the auditor's office. A little over a year ago, we announced that I was going to run to be your state auditor. And I decided to run for state auditor because I know in my term in the legislature that if you have somebody in that office who focuses on making Ohio government more effective, more efficient, more transparent, it can really set the tenor. It is the one agency in state government that can make a difference in the way state government. Started out, we've now traveled over 85,000 miles in our car. We've gone to all 88 counties and attended events in over 80 counties, more than 200 events in total. And we continue to take input from local government officials in the state auditor's office. And from this and from my conversations with the previous auditors, and I'm pleased to announce that I've been endorsed by all of the living Republican former auditors, including Mary Taylor, Dave Yost, Betty Montgomery, and Jim Petro. There are three big things that I talk about with regard to the job of the state auditor's office that I think you need to keep a focus on. Because the state auditor's office does a lot of things. But the three big ones are, one, training and serving local governments. Remember, the state auditor's office, unlike a lady in my hometown that came up to me and said, "Keith, I'm so excited you're running to be state auditor, because now I know who I'm going to write my tax check to." Well, the state auditor doesn't collect taxes. The state auditor doesn't audit individuals. The state auditor's office audits government and people who are interacting with government. And that's why, frankly, I'm a little bit of a geek when I say I get excited about the fact that it's the one place in state government that you can make government work better. And so one of the things you do in that regard is you work with local governments. Local governments are the largest customer base of the state auditor's office. And that's everybody from your local community improvement corporation all the way through state agencies and everybody in between. And so what you need to do is have a positive relationship in working with those local governments because you're auditing their books. And part of that is making sure they know what they're doing. Look, as somebody who used to supervise a fraud group, I can tell you that if somebody has larceny in their heart, I can't stop them from stealing. But if somebody has mere opportunity in their heart, you can put things in place to make sure that you're going to catch those people who have larceny in their heart and then deter those people who don't. And that's where the training comes in, because there are two kinds of mistakes you see in book and in financial matters. One's the mistake of commission, or the error of commission. That's somebody who intends to do it. The second is the mistake of omission. And frankly, that's the large volume that you see in dealing with an auditor's office. people who make a mistake. Now, sometimes people make a mistake because they don't care, and sometimes they make a mistake because they don't know any better. That training aspect of the state auditor's office is a very important, crucial role of our interface and relationship with local governments. And we're going to work real hard to strengthen that bond and that relationship. And we've got some ideas on how to do that, and we can go into that in more detail. But I can tell you that that's a very important component of the auditor's office and something Dave Yost has done a really good job of. The second thing that we talk about, and I kind of hinted about this, is the component of the office where you catch people who are lying, stealing, and cheating. As I said, if you're a government official or you're working in public money and you're lying, stealing, or cheating, I don't care if you're wearing a Republican shirt or a Democrat shirt, I'm not your friend. Frankly, I'm going to be the guy you wish you never saw, because we're going to come after you, we're going to find you, we're going to fix it. It's a very small percentage, and I don't want to tar hardworking government officials, but the reality is those small percentage of people who are in that game for lying, stealing, and cheating, we got to get rid of, because it's a blemish on the rest of the hardworking folks, and we're going to do a lot to make that happen. Dave's got a pretty good program in that, and we're going to continue to grow that. The third area that I talk about is something called performance audits. Now, this is where the uber geeks, people who like numbers like I do, come out and talk about, wow, this is kind of exciting. You get to go into state agencies and local communities, if you're invited, and look at what they're doing and find ways to make them do it better. Remember, government is one of those areas that does not have the competitive forces to force improvement. The private sector has been doing performance audits and performance metrics because it's had to survive and stay competitive. I'm going to try and bring some of those things, building on what the legislature has authorized over the last decade, 6 years or so, by expanding the role of performance audits, particularly of state agencies. And I can give you a lot of examples as to where we can make an inroad, but let me just give you a set of numbers to emphasize a point. The state budget every 2 years, all funds, is roughly $140 billion. That's a lot of money. If we can find just a 1% efficiency improvement, just 1%, it's $1.4 billion. That's roughly the same amount as all of the local government funds. And so if we want to help our local governments, we want to help lower taxes, we want to make government work better, you think we can't do 1%? That's going to be the challenge and why I'm going to be focusing so much on performance audits and looking at data analytics, looking at all the tools that the private sector uses to make government work better. Now, the reality is, we know that if government does a better job at what it spends your money on, then the public policymakers get choices as to what they do with that. Now, I need to emphasize this because I come from a world where I'm one of the public policymakers. I'm not running for state auditor to be a super legislator. In fact, I'm running for state auditor to put on the jersey of a referee. Don't make any mistakes, the auditor's office is a partisan election, but it is not a partisan office. My job as state auditor will be called balls and strikes. And if there's a Republican who makes a mistake, I'm going to call him on it. And if there's a Democrat who does a good job, I'm going to compliment him on it. Because that's the nature of what the auditor's office does. We want to encourage people to do the best they possibly can for Bob and Betty Buckeye. I'm going to give you just two examples of why this is so important. And I can talk about more if you ask questions on this, but two examples. When I was Senate President, we issued the Ohio Senate President's 5% Challenge because we recognize that the cost of higher education is the one thing in our society that's actually gone up faster than health care. It's become a situation where too many Ohio families have gotten into a situation where they literally can't figure out how their kids are going to get that opportunity through education to meet their God-given potential. Now, we can talk about loans and we can talk about a lot of other things, but what we knew was we had to do a better job. So I called all the university presidents, and we reached out to all of them, all the state colleges and universities, and I asked them to do something that was pretty unheard of at the time, to reduce the cost of Ohio college degrees by at least 5%. Now, as you might have guessed, they were really not real excited about this originally. After it became pretty clear that we were going to insist on that, we were going to give some extra tools, and we're going to give them the flexibility to innovate, I can tell you that Ohio college and university leaders took the challenge. And they didn't just take the challenge, they exceeded on the challenge. It's funny what happens when you give the people and people making decisions the power to innovate. When they innovate, you see great things. The result wasn't 5%. And in fact, When we instituted this 3 years ago, the result savings and the reduction of the cost of degrees was an 11.7% savings on average across Ohio. So ultimately, in the last few years, we've reduced the cost of college degrees to students in Ohio by 11.7%. And I know this shocks you, particularly some of my friends in higher education. The world didn't come to an end. They still continue to educate young people. I would argue they're educating young people better. By the way, as my parting gift to them as I left as Senate President, I asked them to do another 5%, and then gave the baton to my successors to try and see how they get that done. And they all looked at me, Keith, we gave you 11.7% when you asked for 5%. Aren't you satisfied? And I said, no, you're never satisfied. Why? Because 17% is better than 11.7%. And ultimately, I think that's the attitude we have to have for government. We have to keep pushing for better and keep hoping and giving people the tools to innovate. Here's another one. My subcommittee, a finance committee that I was fortunate enough to chair, was essentially the State Government Oversight and Review Subcommittee. Our job was to look at some of the administrative agencies and see if we could find some opportunities. And it was predicated basically on a piece of legislation that we passed at the end of the General Assembly when I was president that John Kasich vetoed, that effectively called for a legislative review of the operations of all the state agencies every 4 years. And if they didn't get reviewed or if they weren't reauthorized, the agency could go down the process towards sunsetting. And the goal was to give the legislature back oversight of the agencies, particularly trying to redirect the policy and the mission, and to update and modernize the policy and mission with the current state priorities. Fast forward. One of the things we looked at was the Department of Administrative Services. And we found out that the Department of Administrative Services had overseen a proposal that anybody in here gets has a license other than lawyers. Anybody in here a license that they get from the state? Okay. Those of you who do, you are now going to be required to reauthorize and renew your license using a state database. And you're going to get the joy of paying $3.50 per transaction to use that state database. And the state, in its infinite wisdom, paid $40 million to develop this database. And then it's going to spend roughly an estimated $6 to $6.5 million every 2 years to operate it. And so it came before our subcommittee, and they were looking for a reauthorization of the last little piece of it because they'd already pretty much spent the money. And I asked the question. So you guys went out to the private sector and said, hey, this is a database. I'm sure somebody does a database of similar import, of similar materials. Did you go out and see if you can find somebody to buy this? No, we really didn't look at it. We went and set our specs, and we had them design our specs, and then some of our specs changed on the way, and it changed, and next thing you know, it was $40 million. Did you go out and ask other states? I know it shocks you, but other states also do licensing. Surely somebody's got a good database product we could have borrowed, bought, shared with the cost of? No, we didn't do that. So my office called around to the surrounding states and said, tell us what you spent on developing your database program for your licensing management system. And so we went to Indiana, in part because it's right next to where I live and in part because it's a similar state. And we found out that the state of Indiana spent just under $2 million, originally about half of that, and then they renewed it and updated it after 10 years. A couple of years ago, so spent about $2 million developing their system. And after the gentleman who ran the system says, we don't spend any money to operate it, I said, no, you have to spend some money to operate it. And he finally agreed that he has one IT guy that primarily runs the system. And after I said, well, I'm just going to say that's about $100,000, he said, no, that's way too high. So they spent $2 million developing a system that cost $100,000 a year to operate. And by the way, the lawyers are on that system. How do I know that? Because I'm a licensed Indiana lawyer and I have to go to their system. It works pretty well. It tells me when I have to pay my expenses. It counts my CLEs. It does all the neat stuff it's supposed to do. Now, it does not wash your car on Saturday evenings. I assume the $40 million Ohio system does. The reality is, this is an example of where a performance auditor and the way we do IT contracting would have made a heck of a difference. Just asking those questions. Now, the House inserted a little amendment into the budget that requires now the controlling board to have that information on those questions that we ask before they sign off on an IT contract purchase, which the governor convinced the Senate to take out, so it's not law. But since then, we've learned that there was an inspector general's report and review of the Department of Administrative Services IT contract procuring processes that effectively said what they were doing in their procurement process really wasn't designed to benefit Ohioans. Not sure what it was designed to benefit, but that was the finding. And so it wasn't competitive, it wasn't effective. That's the kind of stuff we've got to get rid of in the way state government operates. Now with that, I'm going to close here and open it up for questions. But I want to end, and I'll do it after the questions, but I just want to reiterate this. The Office of State Auditor is the one place that you can go in state government and improve the way state government operates. We can be better. We can be more transparent. We can be more effective, and it can be done, frankly, with less money. I'm running for state auditor because I know we can do better, and I know that state government has to do better to continue to give our citizens the customer service and the expectations that they have in a more successful, more competitive, frankly, more prosperous society. Questions?
Folks, there are papers on your tables, and we will collect them and ask them. But this is the perk of me getting up here first, because I get to ask them first.
My note card, so I can write your hard questions.
Okay. Actually, they're very easy questions. The answers may be hard. What could and should have been done differently, and by whom, with ECOC?
Look, I'm a strong supporter of school choice, and I believe in school choice. And I believe in school choice largely because I think moms and dads are far better about making decisions about what their kids' education entails than faceless, nameless government bureaucrats. Having said that, I also am somebody who believes if you make a promise and you don't keep the promise, you ought to be held accountable. And that ought to be for school choice, charter schools, voucher schools, and also should be for public schools, frankly. We ought to have higher expectations. Now, with regard to ECOT, look, I'll start and say the concept of online education was something that a lot of us questioned. But early on, the results looked like they were doing an okay job. I actually had one young man from my district who was a competitive clog dancer. I didn't know such a thing existed, but he was an ECOT student. Now, he actually graduated ECOT at about 15, 16, and now I think he went on to go to a very fancy institution and Rhodes Scholar. It worked out well for him. But in the end, it looks like the way they were counting kids didn't work very well. And candidly, I go back to technology. I've actually got a bill that we're working on right now that says online schools will monitor their kids online, and there's a software program, there's vendors out there that do this. Any lawyers had to do online CLE, you know, if you're online, they'll check to make sure you're still there. And frankly, I'm surprised they didn't utilize that program. And that would have changed the whole count. It would also look to see what the kids are doing. Now, there are going to be times the kids are online or are reading or doing something else. They're not sitting there on the computer. But you ought to be able to answer the question what your kids are there and what they're doing on a regular basis. The one other mistake, there's an argument that was made about ECOT, and I'm getting too deep into the woods here. But there was an argument that the Department of Education changed the standard retroactively because originally they said you just have to show us you have kids. And then they came back and said we want to see how many hours the kids are logged on. And ECOT said we didn't have that system. That might be a good excuse for the first set of numbers, but they didn't do anything to try and manage that, the best I can tell, for the second set of numbers, for the second year. And frankly, I think that's unexcusable. I think Dave Yost is right to put down there, but make no mistake about it. This is the reason we passed the Charter School Accountability Bill when I was Senate President. History will tell you that we passed it out of the Senate. Worked on it in the Senate, the House wasn't going to move it. We came back the following period of time, and we worked with the House and got a bill through that I think is largely the reason ECOT's being shut down, along with a number of other schools. So accountability is an important component. Did I answer your question?
You did.
Okay. That's a fair question. I just want to make sure I answered.
Got it. Gun laws.
Okay.
What changes in Ohio would you support?
Again, now you're asking me as a legislator instead of the state auditor, because the state auditor doesn't get to make gun laws. I am a strong believer in the Second Amendment. I think let's distinguish where we're at now for a second, comparing us to Florida. And I heard Mike DeWine come out with a list of proposals yesterday at a Lincoln Day dinner that I thought were really solid. But one of the things we did a couple of years ago was we instilled, frankly, after Chardon, we instilled a series of school safety and school security measures across Ohio schools, and in 2 years ago we expanded and provided some funding for that to go to some of the private and some of the charter and some of the voucher schools as well. That most all school district, every door is locked, and to get into the front door you have to go through a security vestibule in most schools, And in fact, that would have stopped this kid from just walking in a door at that Florida school. The second thing we've done is try to empower school safety officers, generally armed school safety officers, to be in a position to respond. I was devastated to hear that a school security officer was killed in Florida. He was unarmed. You got to wonder what that would have meant and how that would have been if he actually had been armed, whether that would have changed it. But the bigger issue for this Florida shooting, in my view, is mental health issues. And one of the things, and I'm going to give Mike DeWine credit for this because he's the one who announced it yesterday, he plans on putting a school psychologist or school mental health person in every single school in Ohio. And he believes that that will go a long way to identifying and helping kids that have issues. I think that's a good start. But don't forget there were some other failures in this. You also have this, if we're going to say see something, say something, which is absolutely right, you have to make sure you follow up when somebody sees something and says something. And so I think we ought to be open to the concept of having more meaningful discussions about what you do when you find somebody who has a problem and what your options are with regard to that person. And I think that that's a bigger discussion. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I think we ought to regulate guns so that we can do things on the gun side, because the answer to me is that we have a lot of guns in our society. I don't think you're ever going to get rid of them. I think you have to be careful about the people who have access to guns. And candidly, I just don't think we're going to fix that problem by going in and saying, this gun looks like it's meaner than that gun. It's not going to end or solve the problem. I think we need to do things that make a difference instead of things that sound like they make a difference.
Related, what about universal background checks?
Look, I think that's something we should have a discussion for. We do have universal background checks if you buy a firearm from a dealer. The question is how many, and by the way, the last three shootings that we've heard about all went through that process. They're only as good as the data that's in the system. And so I think where we need to make sure, and this is another thing I heard Mike DeWine say, they're going to make sure that all of the Ohio reporting entities are reporting and they're verified that they're reporting. And candidly, that's one of the issues that we have to be solid on.
Okay. With the redistricting issue that is going to be on the May ballot, this is a combination of questions. What in that issue do you think is especially strong, and what do you think is its biggest weakness?
Let's talk about redistricting in general. There are two different types of redistricting, one's for state legislative seats and one's for congressional seats. A couple of years ago, we all passed at the ballot with good numbers a state legislative redistricting approach that I helped draft. We started on it a number of years ago and had some fits and starts with our friends in the House and finally got it out. I remember working with Nina Turner on the very first. You never thought Faber and Nina Turner were going to agree on anything. I loved working with Nina Turner. She was great. But Frank LaRose and then Senator Sawyer worked with us, and Nita Turner and I, and it took us to 4:30, the final night, to get it passed. But I think it had some good things in it. And the big things that I focused on in that proposal are some of the same things that are going to be in the May proposal that's going to be on the ballot. And the first is the importance of drawing compact districts, districts to where the elected official is actually going to represent the constituents in that district. I think that's important. I think it's important that you not divide political subdivisions, whether it's a county or a city or a township or a village. All of those are important because if you can keep things compact, it works better. I come from a county that's a whopping 43,000 people, and we have three congressional representatives. I tried to get us to have one congressman, but it was pretty clear we were going to have two. And at that point, we had a discussion about Grand Lake St. Mary's, which is an area of the state. And we said, fine, might as well have three if one of them's got Grand Lake St. Mary's. It made sense. The reality is, when you look at congressional districts or state legislative districts, people want to be represented by somebody who shares their values. And if you're not doing compact districts, you get away from that. I can draw a district literally from Akron to Columbus if I wanted to achieve whatever demographic result I want to find. But I'm telling you, to do that, I'm having to slice and dice and divide communities. And I think that avoids it. I think the May proposal has that. For a long time, I tend to believe in the United States Constitution when it says state legislatures will draw congressional districts. The Supreme Court said that could be a commission. From that perspective, I like the fact of the one that's going to the ballot in May keeps the legislature involved. I would probably prefer just applying the same standards to the congressional districts in general that we apply to drawing the legislative districts by the redistricting commission. But the reality is I think the process they have is a little clunky on the congressional district, but I think it will work. It starts out that the legislature starts to draw with less requirements. If they can't get a supermajority, bipartisan majority, it goes to the redistricting commission that I'm running for. By the way, the redistricting commission includes the auditor, secretary of state, governor, and four legislators, two Democrats and two Republicans. So that's seven people that will draw the legislative lines and will have a role in the congressional lines if the legislature can't draw them. Then if the redistricting commission can't pass a map with bipartisan support, meaning at least two of the seven people have to, two of the minority members have to join with majority members, very high standard, then it goes back to the legislature to draw a map with lower vote requirements on a bipartisan basis, but more restrictions. They say it gets gerrymandering. So that's the process. I think it's a little clunky, but I think it can be very effective to reach the result we need to have better, more compact, more representative districts. Did I answer that question? That's a complicated
topic.
Did I answer the question?
Okay.
Heads are shaking, yes, so I can stop.
Can you talk specifically about how you see performance audits promoting greater efficiency in state government?
Yes.
Can you offer some specifics?
Sure. I gave one on the DAS. The two areas, there's a list of areas that I think are ripe for performance audits. Remember, performance audits are mandatory with state agency. The auditor has to consult with the Speaker and the President of the Senate to determine which agencies get audits, but they're mandatory on the state level. Local performance audits are permissive, and they have to essentially be requested. We're going to ask local governments to come in and partner with that under a partnership basis, not a gotcha basis. Look, I understand why local government officials don't necessarily like the idea of having somebody from the state come in and tell them they aren't doing a very good job, they could do it better. So what you have to do that is to make process improvement partnership with local government officials. So on the state side, and this is the area we're going to spend most of our attention, is candidly we're going to tee up the Department of Administrative Services procurement methodology, particularly for IT services, because there's literally tens or hundreds of millions of dollars being left on the table. The second area we're going to tee up is Medicaid. And make no mistake, Medicaid is roughly 50% of the state budget. And so just because it's such a large component of the state budget, you have lots of opportunities. But let me give you one example on Medicaid. And then I'll talk about another one that we all care about, and that's opiates. But on Medicaid, by looking at data analytics, you can look at whether billing codes are overbilling, not with absolute certainty, but with some demographic certainty, for certain performance codes. For example, if you've got a hospital or a general type of area that's always billing for the most expensive codes, it may be that that's particularly appropriate because this provider has high acuity patients, very sick patients. But it may be that they figured out how to manipulate the system. You need to ask that second question. And so we're going to look at the processes that the Department of Administrative Services and, frankly, Department of Medicaid uses on making those decisions and how they reach that. The second part is on opiates. Look, we are spending a boatload of money to try and address and get in front of this opiate crisis that we've got in the state. We do a very poor job when the legislature appropriates is saying we're going to use science-based, history-based examples of what works. I don't know what the non-judicial interfaced opiate treatment programs in Ohio have a success rate of less than 20%. Less than 20%. That means for every five people you send, only one succeeds. That's not great. We know when we tie opiate with court intervention and opiate treatment with court intervention, some other things, success rates go up. They don't go up to 100%, but they go up. Looking at what works in programs that are particularly successful versus ones that aren't particularly successful will help us focus very limited state dollars. But the other thing that's part of this is a discussion about alternatives that ought to be used in this treatment mechanism. And the one I'll just give you, and this came from my conversations with some local elected officials, we are spending a lot of money on opiate treatment and opiate through Medicaid. What we're not spending is an equal amount of money on education. There's only 100% successful opiate avoidance program, and that's getting somebody not to start. And if we could spend more money on education to train and teach people not to start, and I'm thinking about this, you remember a couple of years ago, you used to see that frying pan with a couple of eggs? This is your brain on drugs. Okay. enough that I remember it, it had to be fairly effective. But we need to convince kids to not start. And look, I don't think that's the panacea. We got to treat the people who are there. We got to work on all the pressures and societal issues and stop the trafficking and the fentanyl and all of the other things. But it surprises me when we did an analysis of this after some requests is how little money we're spending in comparison on education and prevention. And so that's one of the questions we're going to have to ask. Again, I don't prejudge the results, but I think it's important to have a performance audit of those programs. And we're going to continue to have that discussion across the board. Now, that's just two of them. I can give you another five or six that I think are right. The first one's going to be the Ohio Department of Education. Candidly, it's a not very effective operational agency. So with that, I've answered a couple. So next question.
Okay. The man you hope to succeed, Dave Yost, has been pretty critical of the rollout of the medical marijuana program. Some have called for a halt, at least temporarily, on rolling it out. Where do you stand?
I think when you look at what happened to the Department of Commerce on the rollout of the medical marijuana program, it has a lot of concerns. When you have a felon looking at the applications, I'm really concerned how that ever happened. When you have now the Department of Commerce saying, oh, yeah, our staff had access to everybody's applications and did go in and make a little changes here and there. And oh, by the way, the person who was suing us, we determined that some changes were made, and by the way, they're going to get a permit now. It raises a lot of red flags. And so I think that whole system needs to be evaluated and questioned. Now the problem you've got is once you've made awards and people have started reliance on those awards, what do? Go back and say, hey, we were just kidding. By the way, I know you've broken ground and you're starting to build your facilities and you're trying to get up and running because you have a very narrow time frame to do that. Just kidding. We're going to reallocate. It's the problem of not having the system in place to do it right the first time. And frankly, I'm a little critical of the Department of Commerce for that. The question is how do you fix it, and that's going to be the question that I think has to go to the governor and the legislature. It may be that you have to expand the number of permits that are authorized and redo the reallocation so it's fair and people have confidence in it. The problem we had when we agreed to vote for medical marijuana in this state were that this is an industry, frankly, not unlike gaming, that in other places where it's done have led to questions about confidence and integrity. You cannot have a state-blessed program, in my view, that has integrity problems. I was not in favor of casino gambling in this state. However, when it passed, I got tasked by the then Senate President to draft the regulatory scheme that regulates Ohio gaming. And when we did that, we took great strides to look at what was done in the country and take the best practices from around the country and put them in place. And you have not heard the problems in Ohio's gaming system that they had in some of the other states that started up gaming. And I think it's largely because we brought experts in from around the country and said, tell us what works, tell us what doesn't work. And then we rolled it out slow. And we did it in a controlled way that made sense. Frankly, the marijuana situation, I think, needed the same approach. I was not for medical marijuana expansion. And the reasons for it for me are more about the drug issues that I just talked about. But having said that, if we're going to have it, it needs to be done, it needs to be regulated, it needs to be clean, and it needs to be transparent. And if you ask me a question about transparency, I've got a good answer for that.
Well, first I'll ask you a question about the legislature. What can and should it be doing right now?
I always say you're safer when the legislature's not in session. So right now I would argue the legislative priorities could step back and focus on the things that matter. But the reality is the legislature works pretty well. If your constituents have an idea about what ought to be done, the constituents should bring it to the legislature. And the best ideas, the best legislation, doesn't come from the mind of the legislator. I know this shocks some of you. It comes from the mind of the constituents. And you know, one of the bills I'm working on personally is one that brought from a constituent. And how many of you have gotten a call on your smart device from somebody who said, you just called my number, okay, when you didn't call their number? That's called telephone number spoofing. Okay, and it's being used by scammers and other people. And what they're really doing is stealing your telephone number. It's very deceptive. They do it so people will answer and then think it's somebody local calling. So we've got a piece of legislation that came from a constituent that we're working to try and limit that. Now, reality is some of this is coming from Nigeria. No matter what I do, I can't stop the Nigerian king who wants to give you all his money. But what we can do is try and make it tougher and put some guardrails around it. But largely right now, the legislature should be focusing on the opiate issue, and I think they are. Largely right now, the legislature should be focusing on taking a look holistically at the way state agencies run and frankly, they're doing some of that. I think we could do more.
Well, speaking of how state agencies run, we have a state building in Akron that is not being properly maintained. The Ocasek building has a roof that leaks. What changes at administrative services can be made now to make them do their job better?
Performance audits are the best way to deal with that from the auditor's standpoint, but the reality is I think you have to bring it to people's attention, and sunshine is the best disinfectant. You know, I had this conversation about somebody who said, Keith, you can do the performance audits, but you can't make them do what you say they're going to do. You're right. The auditor doesn't have a club. What I have is a report and the ability to have my friends in the media make sure that those reports are explored and you ask the question of why they're not being implemented. So you use sunshine in that capacity and talk about it. Now you can always call our office or call another legislator's office and get to DAS and figure out why it's not being taken care of. But I just would argue that there are things in DAS that I think need some work.
How do you think what is playing out on the national political stage will be felt in Ohio this year?
Great question. If my crystal ball were that clear, I could tell you it'd be a lot easier to run up for a statewide office. I think ultimately right now, if you look at all the demographics, Ohioans are relatively satisfied statewide on average with what's going on in Ohio. They're relatively satisfied with the fact that we've cut taxes, we've focused on jobs. Ohio seems to be working pretty well. So that, I think, is an interesting turn. I think most Ohioans would say they wish that Donald Trump would stop talking. A lot of people say they're pretty pleased with what the president has done. Cutting taxes, I think, are a good thing. It's spurring economic activity. You're seeing companies now responding to the tax cuts by increasing their employees' wages and giving bonuses. You see a host of other things that are going on that are helping make a difference. Regulatory reform. Frankly, I think most Ohioans like the fact that we did the Common Sense Initiative and has reduced new regulatory filings in this state by 50%. And the fact that by doing that, we really haven't sacrificed clean air, clean water, healthy, safe work environments. That's happening at the national level. So the political environment's an interesting question. If political historians would tell you that the first midterm election for a new president generally doesn't go well for their party. Donald Trump has proven the exception to every other political rule, like how he got elected. I'm confident that that's going to be well, too. And I think when you talk about candidates and differentiate what they stand for and what they're doing, I think Republicans will do just fine in this election cycle.
Okay. There's one more. And it's not a nice wrap-up question like we usually do. Basically, it comes down to, why is the state auditor's position a partisan political position?
Because the Ohio Constitution says it is the quick answer. In some ways, it's not. It's a partisan election. But it's not a partisan position. I have said this around the state for over a year as I've asked people to support me. I'm running for auditor not to be a Republican auditor. I'm running for an auditor to be a good government, clean government, more efficient, effective, transparent government auditor. I think we can do better. And that's why I look early on in my first conversation that I had when I ran for auditor. I built on the fact that we can do better if we're willing to rethink the way we do some common things in government. And one example that I haven't given yet that I think is very important is how we did on public records. We had this issue, public records law, that everybody kind of knew what public records law was. It's just nobody followed it. And then to get your public records, you had to engage in very expensive, time-consuming litigation. I looked at that. I've been a mediator for now 23 years. And I said, this doesn't make any sense. So I sat down and we drafted the public records mediation program. And by doing the public records mediation program, we have successfully taken most public record litigation and ended it. Now for $25, you can file a dispute on public records. And out of the 130 or so, I just got the data on the way up here, or so disputes, almost all of them, but for maybe a dozen or so, resulted in the records being given either pre-mediation or after mediation. And a few went to decision by the magistrate, but in those cases, almost insignificant numbers were appealed. You can make government work better, you just have to think about how it's going and figure out how to do it better. The state auditor's office is the one place in state government that you can do that. And that's why I said when I'm state auditor, we're going to put in part of the management letters that come from an audit, how well you're doing at complying with public records. Because frankly, There's no excuse for a local government or a state agency not to be doing real well on performing and on public records disputes. And so by giving that information to the public in the report, you can help people get better and make it more transparent. But part of that is also saying, okay, city, what are the most 10 most requested sets of public records you have? Why don't you put those online? Instead of having to have people come and say, give me my police report, just put it online where you can type in and get it. In this day of scanners and technology, you can put anything online pretty easily. The point is what are you doing to make that? And we're going to put that as part of our audit report, as part of our recommendations. And I think that's how you make government more transparent. And so to get back to your question as a wrap-up, why should the auditor be a partisan position? It isn't. It's just a partisan election. And I would argue that it's important that whoever your state auditor is wake up every morning saying, what can I do to make Ohio work better for Bob and Betty Buckeye? What can I do to make sure that our kids and grandkids have the same God-given opportunity to meet their potential that our parents and grandparents left us? That's why I'm running to be your state auditor, and that's how I think we can make the auditor's office work better.